Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. As we've said before, legal cases are never far from the headlines, and in many cases, they are the headlines. The Missouri legislature has wound up its session with a lot of new legislation, including some that may not pass constitutional scrutiny. Privacy issues are driving the debate in Washington, and they have a long reach. And some Schnucks customers are moving from the produce aisle to the courtroom. I'm Don Marsh, joined by our legal roundtable panel to discuss these and other issues. They are attorneys all. Mark Smith, Assistant Vice Chancellor at Washington University. He directs the Career Center there. Bill Freivogel is Director of the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale. And Washington University law professor Rebecca Hollander Blumoff. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Good morning.
And Rebecca, as a second timer here, I'm going to start with you. Congratulations. I want to talk about the Schnucks story, and a number of lawsuits have been filed, and I think most people are familiar with the problem they've had with the security breach and resulting fraudulent credit transactions. A couple of people in this room were victimized by that, and many millions more were subject to it. What is going on with these lawsuits? Who's suing and what are the charges?
Okay, so we have two class actions right now, at the least, and one of them is in Missouri, in state court in Missouri, and the other one is in Illinois. It was filed in state court in Illinois, but it has been removed to federal court by Schnucks itself. Schnucks would like to be in federal court, apparently.
Let me interrupt. Has it actually been moved? I know that Ms. Schnucks petitioned to have it moved. Was that granted?
They filed a notice of removal, and that's really all it takes. Okay. Once they file the notice of removal, then it can be duked out in the federal court as to whether it stays there. But as soon as the notice of removal is filed, it's gone. It's in federal court.
Got it. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No. So Schnucks would like to be in federal court. They think they meet the requirements in Illinois. There's diversity of citizenship because Illinois citizens are involved. And based on what the plaintiffs are alleging as their damages, they meet the minimum requirements of the Class Action Fairness Act, jurisdictional requirements. So it looks to me like the jurisdictional situation is pretty good for Schnucks in federal court. What's really interesting is what they're alleging in the lawsuit. The plaintiffs in both Missouri and Illinois are really focusing on a couple things. One, that Schnucks apparently had a system that was hackable, and people are pretty upset about that. And both these suits attack that in a variety of legal ways. And secondly, that Schnucks didn't do more to disclose this information right away.
That they knew well in advance of the publicized event.
Right. They knew in advance. It's not clear how well in advance, but certainly the timeline shows that they knew before they were out in front of it, before they got in touch with consumers, before they had signs up in their store. They knew that something was up, and they were still allowing consumers to continue to use their credit cards at the store. So the Illinois case, there are two counts that are based on Illinois consumer fraud, the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, and one is about this disclosure. One count is about the disclosure. One count is about the hackability. And then there's another count based on the Illinois Personal Information Protection Act, and that's, again, about this failure to disclose information to the public whose cards might have been used. And finally, there's a negligence count in Illinois, and I think a lot of people that really resonates. A big problem potentially for the plaintiffs in Illinois is what kind of damages you're going to be able to get, especially in the negligence suit, which is just a common law tort claim with no specified statutory damages.
Why is it favorable to Schnucks to have it moved to federal court?
Well, a lot of people think that federal court is just a little more sophisticated, a little less kind of prone to sympathies towards plaintiffs. Federal court has been traditionally and in the past few years especially pretty corporate defendant friendly. So I think Schnucks would like to take advantage of that.
So why isn't it moved to federal court here in Missouri?
Well, we don't have the requisite requirements, right? Because this is a Missouri corporation and a Missouri plaintiff. And so there's not any diversity of citizenship. And so they're pretty much stuck in state court.
Do we have any sense of what the plaintiffs are asking?
So the plaintiffs are looking for, in particular, damages due to lost time and effort, it seems, in getting their cards canceled. A really interesting issue here, I think, is that in the typical case, you're looking for some kind of out-of-pocket damage, especially in a class action where each person maybe was overcharged $5. So that's going to add up pretty quickly. But here, the damages are a little bit different because most people who have a credit card company in the wings here are already covered for any damages that resulted from their card being used fraudulently. So a lot of people got calls, hey, are you really in Rio de Janeiro? Well, no, I'm not, so no charges apply. And so those actual damages aren't recompensable for the plaintiffs. No. So we've got to go to kind of another theory, right? We either have to have some kind of statutory damages, say, as maybe provided in a consumer protection kind of a statute, or we're going to be looking at something else. And what it looks like the plaintiffs here are seeking is some kind of recompense for their time and their effort in getting this all sorted out. Well, what's really interesting about that is that's kind of questionable. And in fact, in a really similar case to the Schnucks case that was heard up in Maine, the Hannaford supermarket chain, they actually had to certify that question in federal court to the Maine Supreme Court to say, gee, is it really true that you can get damages for your time and your effort? And the Maine Supreme Court came back and said, no, you know, that's just kind of the normal trouble and pain of stuff going wrong in society. If you had to spend a couple hours sorting this stuff out, you can't get damages for it.
Well, I'm a Schnucks customer, as are other people. How do I become part of this class action?
Well, you should get some kind of notice in the mail. I'm sure you've seen those before, and it'll come to you, and you'll see something, and you can choose to send it back and become part of it.
Wow, that's going to be a couple of million pieces of mail, isn't it?
Is it not? It's going to be a lot of mail. And one thing I'm really curious to see is, and I don't know if any of you here have this thought, but a lot of people are pretty loyal Schnucks customers, very unhappy with what happened, but also very concerned about our litigious nature in society. So I don't know how many people are going to want to be part of this and how many people aren't. I'm not sure, especially for $14. I'm really curious to see.
We have to move on to other things, but before we do, we already have a call that I think will enlighten us somewhat. Matt is calling from Webster Groves. Matt, thanks for being with us. Can you clarify something?
Sure, Dom. My name is Matt Armstrong. I'm an attorney here in St. Louis. Mark Smith knows me. He's my first team of students at the law school. I'm just going to let you know that on April 8th, we filed a case in Missouri federal court, Drew Judge Baker. That case is pending in federal court. We're the first filed federal court case in the Schnucks matter. And it is available online on PACER, Damiano versus Schnucks.
Damiano versus Schnucks. Well, thanks for clarifying that and giving us that correction, Matt. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. And there is just a little bit more, you know, there is an argument that Schnucks makes that that there are no damages. The fact of the matter is one of our clients, for instance, was a woman who lives paycheck to paycheck and is in such straits that she has a monthly payment that she owes Ameren to keep her electricity on. She lost $150 out of her account. It wasn't given back anytime quickly because her debit card was frozen, and she's been without electricity for nearly 2 weeks. So she's trying to scrape enough money together. So there are serious damages to this thing. It's not just a matter of people being inconvenienced.
Matt, we thank you so much for that call. Well, no doubt this is a real can of worms, and it's going to be a long time before we get all of this resolved. Thank you, Rebecca, for bringing us up to speed on all of that. Most interesting case. I'm going to turn to Bill Freivogel now because, Bill, you're a longtime journalist and now head the journalism school at SIU in Carbondale. I know you're watching what's been going on with the Attorney General's office and the Associated Press and subsequently with other reporters, national reporters, with regard to tracking phone records. What's your take on this and what are you hearing from colleagues about it here?
Well, let's see. My take on it is that what you have here are two legitimate interests that are in competition. The government has a legitimate interest in protecting national security secrets. The press has a legitimate interest in trying to report on matters that may touch on national security secrets. In general, the law says that a government employee who leaks a classified document can be prosecuted. Nobody claims that there's a First Amendment right for a government employee to leak a document. In general, the press that is in receipt of a classified document can publish that without being prosecuted. The First Amendment there does trump it. So it's clear that the Justice Department had the legal authority to subpoena these AP reporters' records. Where I think it becomes a little bit controversial is that it was a very broad, maybe the broadest such subpoena that people can remember. It involved 100 different AP reporters and three different bureaus, Hartford, New York, and Washington, I think.
And switchboards,
yes. But then on the other hand, this was a really serious leak. The story that was published, at least according to administration officials, the story that was published caused them to have to give up on a double agent who was, they thought, going to be able to locate the lead al-Qaeda bomb maker. So they felt it was a very damaging leak. My own feeling is, reporters have really jumped on this, and I think, my journalistic instincts go that direction. On the other hand, I feel like the press hasn't exactly covered it very fairly. I don't think very many people would realize that news organizations are actually in a preferred position. The Justice Department has these Attorney General's guidelines that Elliot Richardson put into effect in 1973. And what they say is, in a normal case, in a run-of-the-mill case involving a typical suspect, the government could go ahead and get the phone records and bank records and just proceed with their investigation. When a news organization is involved, these Attorney General guidelines come into play, and what it says is the prosecutors have to try every other way they can to get the information, and if they're unsuccessful trying other routes, they should disclose it to the news organization and try to negotiate it, unless that might threaten the investigation, which I think they did think it would in this case. So for example, the Justice Department in the AP case had interviewed 550 witnesses and looked at tens of thousands of documents before they went ahead to try to get these 2 months of phone records. So there's some on each side. The James Rosen thing is a little different. James Rosen's is Fox. I guess he's an anchor of some sort on Fox. And the difference is that there actually seems to be the suggestion that Rosen himself might have crossed the line and been a conspirator or an accessory to trying to get the government secrets. I mean, he sent to the State Department official – this involved North Korea. He sent to the State Department official emails that said specifically said – I'd sure like to get my hands on specific intelligence analyses, on memos. Give me the evidence.
You wanted scoops.
Right. So I mean, the line for a reporter is, I mean, a reporter can receive the information. The news organization can publish the information, national security secrets, without being prosecuted. But you can't go to a CIA agent or a State Department official and say, hey, will you get me this particular document? Now, so the Rosen thing is a little bit – is a gray area. He didn't ask for a particular document, but he asked for a whole category of documents. So it's a little complicated.
I'm running late for a break, but very quickly, are your colleagues here concerned about a chilling effect as a result of this?
Yes, they are. And, the 50 news organizations wrote to the Attorney General's office expressing just that concern, that, if reporters' records are used by the government as a way to investigate the leaks, that there will be a chilling impact on news gathering.
Everywhere, not just in Washington.
And the Obama administration has been very aggressive about going after these leaks, right?
Yeah, there have been six people prosecuted for leaking national security secrets, and that's twice as many as all the previous administrations combined.
And very quickly, will we be looking at a national shield law, do you think, as a result of this?
I don't think a national shield law will pass. But that's sort of been the Obama administration's response is, hey, we were for a national shield law all along, and we're still for it. Shield to protect confidential sources.
Okay, great for that that setup, Bill Frygwell. I've got to take a break. Mark, don't go away. We haven't forgotten you. We'll come back and talk with Mark about Sharia law in just a moment and many other things. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our legal roundtable discussion today with Mark Smith of Washington University, Bill Freivogel of SIU in Carbondale, and Washington University Law Professor Rebecca Hollander-Blumhoff. Okay, anybody want to amplify anything with regard to what either Rebecca or Bill has said before I go to Mark?
I just add one. There's one local angle to the subpoena thing. You know, we have our own local person, Jeffrey Sterling, who was charged 2 years ago with violating the Espionage Act for having supposedly leaked information to James Risen of the New York Times. Yep. And, you know, in that case, the Justice Department subpoenaed Risen's travel records, his cell phone records, et cetera, called him before a grand jury. So we have a good example of this.
Yep. He's a WashU law grad.
He is a WashU law grad.
And I want to add one thing, too. I want to thank Mr. Armstrong for calling in. That was terrific, and I appreciate it. One thing his call highlighted, though, was some of the difficulty that can occur when you have a class action, because one thing that's really important in a class action is that everyone is similarly situated and that everyone has the same kind of damages. And so a case where we have a really idiosyncratic, terrible situation is a little harder for a class action to go forward on, right, because you don't have thousands and thousands of people who are affected in the same way that the class action requirements really rely on.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. And now, Mark Smith.
Sure.
You've been kind of taken by the Sharia law aspect, a law. It was not passed by the General Assembly, but what the General Assembly basically said was that nobody would be subject to any foreign law, including Sharia law, here in the state of Missouri. So that can't happen. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it just it's kind of frustrating because it seems like they're dealing with problems that aren't problems. It's kind of like, you know, regulating the speed of spaceships coming over Missouri and saying they can't fly faster than 2,000 miles an hour. I don't really know we have an issue with that. And the same with the Sharia. You know, there's nobody's imposing Sharia law in Missouri. Where I think it's even more troubling is it says that you can't agree to be bound by other types of law and any law that's inconsistent with Missouri. And so most laws, you know, are not identical, so they would be inconsistent. So if Rebecca and I had some kind of agreement and we decided that we wanted that agreement to be governed by canon law, the Catholic Church's law, or by Talmudic law, or we wanted it to be bound by the laws of Canada on this particular deal, mm-hmm. for whatever reason, we're businessmen and we want to do that, we can't do that anymore. And that seems to make Missouri into kind of a parochial state where we can't kind of, you know particularly with we're trying to enter the international marketplace and now our business people can't do that. I think that's problematic.
It seems that this is the result of a certain kind of hysteria that takes place in certain parts of this country with regard to the Islamic world and its role in world events today.
Right. We have this one, and we also have the Agenda 21. The legislature passed a law saying no Missouri township can adopt the principles of Agenda 21, which I had to look up. Apparently it's some UN on one of their environmental conferences on sustainability, some proposals. The United States has not signed off on it. We're not subject to it. And so once again, we're avoiding a problem that's not really there. But there would be people on the other side who would tell you, oh, this Agenda 21 is going to keep you from living in the suburbs and it's going to take your car away. I don't think that's a real possibility.
Yeah. We did a program on the legislative session on Monday, and some of the journalists here were saying many of these things are just put out there and voted upon so that the legislators can take it back to their constituents and say, this is where I stand on these things. We're seeing a lot of that lately, not only in the state of Missouri, but all states, and certainly we're seeing it in Washington.
Although I think the Agenda 21, only one other state has adopted it, Alabama, so we're number two. And then the other thing is, while they're doing this, they're leaving hundreds of millions of dollars on the table by not being able to do anything with Medicaid. Yeah. So that's, I think, some of the frustration.
I'm surprised anybody understands Agenda 21. I mean, I looked at it here. It says it would bar the implementation of Agenda 21, which this is a legislation that's approved, a non-binding United Nations action plan that promotes sustainable development.
Yeah.
Come on. We have a question from a listener I have on the computer here. It says, will the anti-Sharia law impact other religions, such as Orthodox Jews?
Yeah. It says it's not limited to Sharia law. It says you can't have any law that's inconsistent with Missouri law. So I think that would say we couldn't have a contract that says we're going to be governed by Talmudic law, by canon law, by it's not just Islamic law.
Okay. Rebecca, any comment to that or Bill?
One thing that I think Mark makes a great point about is that you really can't choose any other system of law that doesn't grant the same rights that the Missouri Constitution grants. So even other states in our country might be violations of this law.
Now, wait a minute. We have a new gun law in the state of Missouri in which basically the law says that Missouri law is going to trump any federal law on gun issues.
Yeah, this is that. this is I would put this in the same category.
Actually, I think this one's even worse.
Maybe
than the other
even
ones.
Worse.
Yeah.
It really the whole view of the law, if you read it, is it's like a nullification pre-Civil War view of what the Constitution's about. It says every state gets to decide on its own what power Congress has. And Congress didn't have power to pass any gun laws. And so we're going to ignore the Gun Control Act of 1934. We're going to ignore the Gun Control Act of 1968. And the federal government doesn't have any power in this whole area of guns.
However, federal law trumps state law.
However, there's a supremacy clause, right, which is in the Constitution, which says federal law trumps state law.
And again, I think this is very much in keeping with what we were discussing earlier about these legislatures using laws to really just make statements that aren't necessarily going to carry any actual political or legal force. They're going to be used to talk about what I did in Congress with my constituents, what I did to show that, you know, I believe in X, because as you know, the supremacy clause is in charge here. And so the Missouri state legislature can't just agree to not follow federal law, right? And we saw this in the Affordable Care Act legislation. We saw state after state after state enacting laws that said, oh, no, that law doesn't apply here.
Well, this is going to be challenged on the Constitution, the supremacy clause.
And there was a similar law passed in Florida because there's a provision. One of the things they were worried about is apparently the Obama administration has said that doctors cannot be prohibited from asking, like when you come into the pediatrician to ask, do you have any guns in the home? So you can make sure they're secure. Just like my pediatrician always asks, every time we go in, you don't have one of those trampolines in your backyard, do you? Because I don't want your kids on them. And Florida passed a law, and it was struck down in Florida because of exactly what you said, supremacy clause issues. So somebody will challenge it.
There were other parts of that law.
If it even gets signed, which I doubt.
Yeah, well, that's the first step of whether or not Governor Nixon.
He's
in a tough spot. This is a gun state. You know, he's got political ambitions.
Right, and he doesn't have to sign it. He can just do nothing and let it.
And that gives him his out, saying, I never signed the law. Other parts of that law, by the way, which has not gotten as much attention because of the supremacy issue. Minimum age would be lowered. That requires the consent to obtain a concealed weapon from 19 or to 21 from to 19 from 21. Let me get my own notes straight here. It allows concealed weapons to be carried by designated school personnel in school buildings. Other parts of the law, which is now law in Missouri, we'll see where that goes. Okay. Certainly since our last get-together when we talked about Monsanto and its suit before the Supreme Court, the court ruled on that. And Bill, I'll ask you because I think you're pretty conversant with this. Remind us of that issue and what the Supreme Court did.
Well, there was a farmer in Indiana who had decided that he had a way around Monsanto's patent on Roundup Ready soybeans. And what he did was he would buy some commodity soybeans out of the local grain elevator and use them to plant a crop. And since most soybeans these days have Monsanto Ready, have Roundup Ready characteristics, surprise, his soybeans that he bought out of the grain elevator had those characteristics, and so he was able to get them for much less money. And this Monsanto figured out pretty soon that he wasn't buying enough soybean seed for his for the crops he was harvesting, and challenged him. It went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided that Monsanto was right. This was Elena Kagan. It was a unanimous decision. It only took them 10 or 11 pages to write their opinion, which is extremely brief, indicates not a very difficult case for them. I mean, what they said, for example, so there's this, the legal issue is what's called patent exhaustion. And so, you know, once a patented commodity is sold, a person gets to use it however they want to. But what they can't do is they can't replicate it and then go into competition with the original manufacturer. So, for example, the example that Elena Kagan gave was, let's say you were to buy a machine. You couldn't then copy the machine and sell it in competition with the original manufacturer. Same thing on Roundup Ready soybeans. And, you know, she pointed out that if you only got one sale in before somebody could copy it and go into competition with you, what value would the patent be? And this has all sorts of ramifications for other kinds of genetic engineering and advanced products.
Huge victory for Monsanto.
Yeah.
Any comment from the others?
One thing I thought was really interesting, because there are potentially such far-reaching consequences, is that Justice Kagan took pains to suggest that this opinion really should be pretty narrowly read as limited to the facts at hand. And I thought that was worth noting.
The court also seemed to imply that there was a license to plant these seeds when you buy them from Roundup, and not when you buy them the second time. And even if that's not specifically stated in the first purchase. So I think they're going to have to kind of evolve that a little bit, because it's, you get this idea that if you buy the seeds and I plant them and I harvest the seeds, I cannot plant those seeds. I'm prohibited from doing it. So,
okay. Well, congratulations to Monsanto on its win. And
not an
the poor farmer
decision.
In Indiana who's, I'm sure, not very happy. Okay, I'm going to open this up to all of you here, and this is the big story out of Washington, one of a couple of big ones, concerning the IRS targeting Tea Party and nonprofits, targeting their tax returns. I think most of us are familiar with what's going on there. This is a big, big privacy issue. And then there was the case yesterday where the IRS official went before a congressional committee and invoked the Fifth Amendment. And it was claimed by one of the people on the panel that she read an opening statement. This is Lois Lerner. She read an opening statement, and once you do that, you can't take the Fifth. Who's right here?
Well, I think in a court of law, if she had done this in a court of law, that she would have waived her Fifth Amendment right. You can't say, I'm innocent, I didn't do anything wrong, and I won't answer any questions, so I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment. You can't do – you would have waived it if it were a court of law. Now, this was a congressional committee, so the same kind of waiver rules may not apply. Let's assume, though, that you come to the conclusion that she did waive her right. So then what would happen? So Congress would have to declare her to be in contempt of Congress. I think that probably the Republican majority would vote for that pretty quickly. Then they have to refer to the U.S. attorney. The U.S. attorney's not going to do anything with it. The U.S. attorney's an Obama appointee. It would die. Mm-hmm. So maybe she didn't waive her right. I think probably she did not waive her right since it was a congressional committee. Even if the House of Representatives claims she did and holds her in contempt, I don't think it will go anywhere. I think politically, probably the Obama administration, White House, would wish she would just answer the questions. This is the last thing they want, is somebody up there taking the Fifth Amendment, because everybody always assumes that means you're guilty.
Right. And the gentleman who followed her on the stand answered questions for 6 hours, as I understand it. But just to clarify one thing, and you guys chime in on this. You mentioned that what you can do in a criminal court, but can't you in a criminal court, if you're being questioned, at some point during the questioning, if they ask a question of you that you don't want to answer, invoke the Fifth Amendment? I mean, you answer questions, but one comes to you you don't want to answer. Can't you invoke the Fifth?
I think you can, but
I was under the impression you can't.
I think the big issue here is it's a congressional fact-finding. It's not a criminal case. So she can give her statement. I mean, that's what Mark McGuire did, if you remember, in his case. He came in and said, I didn't take steroids, by the way, but I'm not going to answer anything. I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment. Mm-hmm. It happens all the time. I think they had the Congress people had a very smart try at saying you waived it, and maybe they almost got her to buy it, but I don't think it would work there. And you know, it's different than, you know, in a civil case, you can plead the Fifth, and they – it's like a civil case in that you can plead the Fifth in a civil case, but then the court can the jury can assume, well, that means you did it. But in a criminal case, you can't make that assumption. We have the right not to and not have it used against us. You don't have that right in civil, and I don't think you have that right in Congress, but they're going to go out and do their fact-finding in other ways, I think.
Rebecca.
I had the same question that you had, Don, and part of my question really relates to Mark's point, which is what are the consequences for failing to answer the question? Yeah. Are you going to be held in contempt if all of a sudden after a whole line of questioning you say, well, now I'm going to invoke my Fifth Amendment rights? Or what seems more likely to me is just that you're not going to get the full protection of the Fifth Amendment. You can stop answering, but you're not going to have the same right to not have any inference drawn against you for failure to answer. You know, that seems more like a possibility to me.
I'm having trouble getting my arms around being held in contempt for invoking a constitutional right.
Well, it would be that she waived the right. She commented on the subject. It's called a subject matter waiver. That she commented on the subject of the subject and then went on to refuse to answer questions. And so, by commenting initially, she waived her right. That would be the argument. Mm-hmm. And you know, the House of Representatives might buy that argument.
To hold her in contempt, though, wouldn't they need to give her some kind of immunity? And I'm not sure could they give her immunity in this kind of. Remember the Oliver North thing?
Right.
I think I don't know that they could just hold her in contempt for using her Fifth Amendment right unless they somehow gave her immunity, assuming they could.
We'll see.
Well, I mean, if their waiver argument is right, if she really did waive it, then but if she did, you know, I kind of agree that the lesser option is the contempt. I think what's more likely to happen is just we're going to take an inference that, you know, what you would have said is pretty negative.
I was listening to Rush Limbaugh yesterday, who was very mad at ISA, the chairman, for not having kept her up there and asking her like a whole series of you know, 20, 30, 40 questions. Asked as many questions as you want. Make her say it again and again and again. So I think ISA is clearly under a lot of conservative pressure to have a redo on this. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see her come dragged back up there and forced to answer it a bunch of times.
Some of us remember the McCarthy hearings way back when that's all you heard for a long time.
These hearings, they're trying to make, you know, one congressman made a connection to, this is just like Benghazi, or this is just like the pipeline that Obama won't build. I mean, they're just using, there's not a really rational line to connect these dots, but they're trying anyway.
It's all political. Let's take another break. We'll do that and continue our legal roundtable discussion with Bill Freivogel, from whom you've just heard. He is director of the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale. Also with us is law professor Rebecca Hollander-Blumoff of Washington University and Mark Smith, assistant vice chancellor at that very same university. We'll open up the phone lines now. If you have questions or comments with regard to what we've talked about, there is more to come, more subjects to discuss, and we'll do that in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our legal roundtable discussion today with Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Rebecca Hollander-Blumoff. Mark, you wanted to get back into the previous issue.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we talked a little bit about this Fifth Amendment right, but there's also the issue of what happened at the IRS. And I think everyone would agree what happened was wrong. But I think the question is what laws were broken and also what has given rise to this. So if they were – I think it's much easier to make the case – and there's a class action lawsuit, I think, that's been filed by a Tea Party a group in California. I think it's a class action. But you know, if it turns out they were – the groups they were going after were both conservative or liberal, then I think it's going to be a little tougher because – these groups, 501c4s, are what are the social welfare? No, what are they called? Social.
That's close enough.
They
claim that
they're not supposed to be political groups.
Yeah, right.
But there's not been clear guidance from the IRS of how much kind of activity they can do. And then, like we were talking during the break, a lot of this is the Citizens United case, which we talked about, which was came out a couple of years ago.
Corporations, you know, are people.
Right. And so with these 501c4s, you get a deduction. If you give to a political candidate or to a party, you don't get a deduction. you get a deduction for this, and you get to hide who you're supporting, and that's great for people.
There's a hang-up over the word primary also with regard to, I think you can have 49.9% versus 50.1%
for your primary purpose.
Right.
So these sort of vague guidelines, the primary purpose can't be political. For the 501c4s, there were Karl Rove's, his 501c4s were very active in the election. And as Mark says, the Citizens United said you can give this unlimited amount of money. They also said, the Supreme Court said, you can force disclosure of the donors. However, the 501c4s have become the vehicle by which you can hide those donors' identities.
Well, wouldn't you expect the IRS to want to take a close look at that for any of these organizations? I mean, that's the way they determine whether or not they're following the law.
Yeah, they should.
There's apparently 300 groups. 100 of them are clearly like Tea Party groups. But I think the question is, who are these other 200? Now, if the other 200 all turn out to be conservative groups, I think they got a better argument. If the other 200 groups turned out to be liberal groups and, just groups with different agendas, then I think it's the issue becomes, well, we were looking for groups that were violating these regs and doing political speech instead of the social welfare part.
We have an email from Sue who wants to revert back to an earlier subject. She writes, how does Monsanto monitor what farmers are doing or where they buy seed, how much they buy, how much they plant, and so on?
I think we talked about this before. I think they have, if I'm paying for the seed and you're the farmer next door and you're not paying for the seed and I know, I think sometimes I'll turn you in. And I think they have people who come out and talk to them and try and work it out before they sue them. Monsanto doesn't want to sue anyone.
These are sometimes referred to as the seed police.
Yeah.
And I believe Monsanto does have a hotline that you can call and turn in your neighbor. And I think they get quite a few tips. And what happens is a couple of Monsanto men arrive at your farm. That's what happened to Hugh Bauman, the Indiana farmer.
Yeah.
He was in his machine shed, and they arrived and said, how are you getting all these crops?
Okay, we can leave that for the moment and go to some other things, many of which we've discussed before, but I'd be interested in getting your take. With regard to this, going back to the legislative session, the legislature did not pass legislation to establish a gun court in the city of St. Louis, which was something we've talked about, and which was something that folks in the city, folks of position, seem to want. Any thoughts about why this didn't happen or what it means?
I don't know why it didn't happen. It seems like a disappointment. I don't know if it was because of costs or because the magic word gun, but we had Jennifer Joyce with us a few months ago, and they seemed to like that idea, and the mayor liked it to show that this, you commit a crime with a gun, it's going to be handled quickly, and we're taking this very seriously.
Somewhat surprising, because issues like this, oftentimes politicians like to
look strong and tough on crime, exactly.
Which takes me to the next issue here, and that is updating the criminal code, which is something we've talked about before, and which is something that very influential judges and former judges have talked about here as being absolutely necessary. Dies on the vine. Surprise?
Yeah, I think that's a very long and complicated bill. Passed one house and not the other, because the other felt as though it needed more time to look at it. But it is a compromise that has been reached between prosecutors and defenders. You'll remember that we had Mike Wolff, the former the dean at SLU and Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court, saying he did not really favor it himself because it created more felonies, and he thought that felonies wrecked people's lives with great consequences. This is the Cliff Notes version of Mike's argument. I don't know that Mike's argument had any effect in this not getting through. I sort of guess it will next time around. But it goes – both these things, I think, to a certain extent, go back to Mark's point about they spend this time on Sharia law and these ridiculous gun laws that violate the Supremacy Clause. And they're not taking care of business.
And with this criminal reform, like Bill said, I mean, the public defender representatives and the prosecutors agreed. They don't agree on anything ever. So the fact that they're saying we're okay with this, That's a big deal. And then to let it die on the vine, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Right. And after 30 years, it's probably about time for an update.
Yeah. Well, we have a call from Normandy, which we'll take. We're going back to our favorite subject of the day, which is Agenda 21. Jay, go ahead, please. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, guys, should I be worried at all about any of these issues, such as Agenda 21? I mean, I'm not worried. I think it's silly that the legislature of this state got involved in it. I'm saying, is it what the legislature have done? Is it meaningless on that? And also about, I want to know where to concentrate my efforts, I guess, in calling Governor Nixon and saying, you know, don't sign any of these ludicrous bills. And on one serious issue, I'm trying to get solar panels installed at a house, and I want to know if you guys have heard anything that's going to hurt the Prop C that's on the books and Ameren's having to pay a third of solar installation. So those are my points. Thanks.
Jay, thanks for the call. Well,
I think these bills are innocuous. I mean, I wouldn't get that worked up about them. I mean, I do think there are some ramifications beyond what they probably intended. But I don't think for an average person it's going to have that big of an effect.
But you might get worked up about having a legislature that is spending its time doing this as opposed to the important issues that face the state. I don't know anything about solar panels. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't either.
Sorry.
All right. Jay, sorry. We're drawing a blank on that. Let's go back to some of the legislative activity here. And this one caught me a little bit by surprise. Perhaps it did you too. And that is that they did not approve a bill on voter ID requirements. Talked about that. There was a lot of talk about it prior to the legislative session. And I think it was a foregone conclusion they probably were going to do that. Did I misinterpret what people were thinking?
I thought it would probably happen too, and I don't know what exactly the politics were there. The background is that Missouri threw out the previous voter ID requirement law, and subsequently, that was about 6 years ago, maybe. Subsequently, the U.S. Supreme Court said voter ID laws do not violate the federal constitution, and so what the legislature has to do is like a two-step, I think, where they would get a constitutional amendment passed and then some legislation implementing. And this is the second session in a row, if I'm remembering correctly, that hasn't gotten done.
Yeah. A little bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's take another call. We have Richard calling from St. Louis. We'll go back to Sharia law. Mark, are you ready?
Yeah.
Richard, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. On the discussion on Sharia law, my question is my reading, I thought that Smith versus State of Oregon decided by the Supreme Court, including the, I believe it was 8-1 or 9-0, Judge Scalia very clearly clarified the limits of religious law. So my question is, those who are proposing this rather global law seem to be avoiding a conflict which seems to be already taken care of by Smith versus State of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. You were nodding there, Rebecca. Do you have a thought there?
I think it's a great point. I'm not familiar with the case Smith versus State of Oregon, but I think that this very much is in keeping with what we've been talking about today, which is the legislature spending a lot of time passing laws that are sort of already governed by other things, already covered by other areas, or just aren't going to have any impact at all. So
Smith versus State of Oregon is a free exercise of religion case. It was some Native Americans in, I believe it was Oregon or Washington, claimed they had a First Amendment free exercise right to smoke peyote as part of a religious observance.
Oh, yeah.
Supreme Court said no. The Supreme Court, and it was Justice Scalia, I don't think it was 8-1, however, it was Justice Scalia who said that generally applicable state laws are not trumped by the First Amendment. So if you have a generally applicable state law in other words, it applies to everybody the same, as in you can't smoke peyote, you can't then say, well, it's part of my religion, so I get to trump that state law. This has come up more recently in Missouri in that whole whole case about what kind of whether or not we can force, whether or not the Obama administration can require there to be medical insurance for contraceptive medical insurance that is provided for employees of religious hospitals.
Okay. You know,
also on this religion case, wasn't there in that St. Stanislaus case, wasn't there an attempt to say this should be governed by canon law? And I think even in that case, the court said, no, we're just going to go by regular Missouri law and we're going to decide this case. And that's what happens all the time. We're you know, if it's in federal court, we are under federal law, we'd look at federal. And the only way you would get other laws involved is if there was some agreement to do that.
Well, move along. Thank you for your call. And let's take another one. Joe is calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm curious how the legislature can propose to cut income tax when they haven't met their obligation to education. They haven't fully funded the education formula, and I don't know when the last time was.
No, that's a little bit off point, but certainly
we're lawyers, not accountants.
I think, you know, taking a little bit of a legal approach to that is I don't believe, you know, I believe that there was a lawsuit several years ago. Again, I'm in the sort of 5 or 6 year range here, where there was an attempt to try to get the Missouri Supreme Court to require full funding of the education formula. In other words, that the legislature had a constitutional or a legal duty to do that, and I think the Missouri Supreme Court said that no dice. But don't hold me to the exact details of that. But so I don't think, you know, bottom line, I don't think there's a legal or constitutional requirement that the Missouri legislature fully fund the formula.
Let me bring up another subject. This passed by the legislature, which imposes restrictions on abortion-inducing drugs. Any thoughts about that? They're talking about RU486, I believe.
Yeah, this is RU486, saying the doctor has to be present. This is one of a host of state legislative enactments trying to further limit the abortion right that's recognized in Roe and then later in the Casey decision. And I think it probably has legal problems. I noticed just recently that many of the other states have passed laws that say that you can't have abortions after 20 weeks. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals out on the West Coast threw out Arizona's law to that effect. I guess there's a move in Congress to pass a similar law. This is all an attempt to get the Supreme Court to reconsider Roe versus Wade and the Casey decision.
So it was both this RU 86 and the wasn't the webcam abortions banned? Wasn't that another law that came out? But I think a lot of it has to do with what side of the abortion debate you're on. If you're pro-life, you say, well, this is about safety, and we should have a doctor there because you apparently take the pill twice, and they'll point to some statistics, you know, that show it. And then if you're on the pro-choice side, you say this is just a way to inconvenience women, and it's, you know, you wouldn't do this with other things. And so, you know, it's just, I think, the which side you're on.
Do you see problems with it, Rebecca?
Well, I think that this was, in fact, the bill that was about the Skype abortions. It's the same. Mm-hmm. The idea was the first dose of this you have to take in the presence of an actual physician rather than over a webcam. But as I understand what ended up being in the bill, they actually removed a more onerous provision, which would have required the second dose of the medication to be also given in the presence of a physician. And that was actually quite onerous because it was a second dose that was going to come at a time when a lot of women would be really negatively physically affected and would not want to leave the house. And so that, as I understand it, was an amendment that didn't there was an amendment that took that second requirement out.
Well, here again, Governor Nixon, I guess, holds this in its
and he's
its
got
future.
Three choices, like we talked about before.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And, you know, this is a legislature that can, if all the Republicans hold together, can override his vetoes.
And it's not just Republicans on the abortion one.
It's not just Republicans on the abortion. That's right.
Less than a minute left, so this can't be extensive. The Supreme Court, by the next time we meet, perhaps, will have decided the Defense of Marriage Act. Very, very quickly, I'll start with you, Mark. What's your prediction?
Okay, so on defense, because they've got two gay rights, I think they're going to say defense of marriage, they'll strike it down saying this is an issue for the states. But on the California one,
Proposition 8.
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do on that.
Rebecca, any thoughts? Hate to put you on the spot.
No, I think that with respect to the Defense of Marriage Act, I think that's going to be, based on the questioning, I think that's going to be a tough one for the Supreme Court to uphold. That's right. My prediction.
Yeah, I think they'll throw out the Defense of Marriage Act. I do not think they will constitutionalize gay marriage, and I think they'll find some procedural way to get out of the Prop 8 thing that probably results in Prop 8 not being in effect.
Okay, well, we'll have to wait and see until our next discussion here on the Legal Roundtable. Thank you, Mark Smith, as usual. Rebecca Hollander-Blumoff, thank you so much for being with us
and
participating. Bill, thank you again for being with us. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk about Shakespeare Festival St. Louis's production of Twelfth Night, Opera Theater of St. Louis's season-opening production of Pirates of Penzance, and the Black Reps production of The Wiz. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll revisit our discussion with Louis Gerteis about the Civil War in Missouri. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Spencer Reed, and Hannah Durham. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.